From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for July 26th, 2019. The Germans are coming. The Germans are coming. It's German Fest this weekend at the lakefront. Also at the lakefront this weekend, it's the Air and Water Show with the Air Force Thunderbirds. And with a little luck, one of those Thunderbirds will fly by the studio during the broadcast. Now for something completely weird. It's Weird Al Yankovic at the Milwaukee Theater this Saturday. And the Brewers are home all weekend with the Chicago Cubs. Okay, in the canal surrounding the South Florida nuke plant, hundreds of crocodiles are spawning faster than wildlife agents can get rid of them. There must be something in the water because fishermen don't use fish finders, they use Geiger counters. And finally, it's an election year in Japan, and the campaigns are just as nutty and goofy as ours. Japanese Prime Minister Abe, at a recent campaign rally, asked for votes from everyone in attendance, and then asked them to ask distant relatives, friends, co-workers, spouses, girlfriends, and mistresses to vote for him as well. Well, I'm not sure how big a voting block mistresses are, but that does seem like a whole lot more fun than explaining the Electoral College. In the studio today, we have Brian Kilb, Art Rothschild, Adam Bailey, Joel Dreesang, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. Another strong week for the S&P as it closed back above 3,000 after sliding below that threshold the week prior. Early in the week, the House passed a two-year spending agreement that pushed up the federal borrowing limit until July of 2021, easing concerns of a budget debate prior to the 2020 election. Meanwhile, Boris Johnson won the race to become UK Prime Minister in the most recent chapter of the Brexit saga. It's now been over 3 years since the initial referendum that surprised markets. Strong earnings from some of the larger tech companies edged markets higher despite ongoing concerns of pending antitrust regulations. Also, a higher-than-expected initial reading on second-quarter economic growth was punctuated by strong consumer spending that highlighted the divide between the manufacturing economy, which has slowed recently, and a robust consumer. Next week, the Federal Reserve will take over the news cycle as they are likely to cut short-term interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point as central banks look to combat a slowing global economy. As I mentioned, a good week for stocks. For the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up just a tenth of a percent to close at 27,192. But in the broader markets, the S&P 500 up 1.7% this week to close at 3,026, and the NASDAQ up 2.3% to close at 8,330. For the year, the NASDAQ now up 26.3%, the S&P up 22%, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 18.1%. So obviously a pretty good year so far. I think the big piece of news this week, maybe to lead with, is that second quarter GDP report that came out. Joel, maybe as kind of the resident researcher of the economy here, I wonder if you maybe want to just shed a little light on what's going on, and then we all can dive a little deeper, perhaps, into what that means.
Statistician, I'm just putting the numbers down. Yeah. So as you mentioned, Kyle, the second quarter was really strong for consumer spending, and that's important because consumer spending generates more than two-thirds of our economic growth. So that was good, especially because first quarter growth for consumer spending was anemic. So this was consumer spent at an annual pace of 4.3% in the second quarter. That was the highest quarter in six quarters. So that part is good. But there were other parts that were a little mixed. We've pointed out on this podcast before that in the first quarter, there was a jump in inventories and exports, and it was mentioned on this podcast that those probably wouldn't stay up, and sure enough, this quarter both of those went down. The other thing was that this is the sixth quarter in a row that housing was a drag on economic growth. So that's been a concern. We had other reports this week that punctuated what's going on in the housing industry. Also, another strength in this report was government spending. So if not for that government spending, you know, it would have been a weaker quarter even more so. And again, it was 2.1% pace for the growth of the economy, which is down from 3.1% in the first quarter. But it's stronger than analysts were expecting, and it's still pretty good at this point in the cycle.
And Joel, I think, obviously encouraged by that consumer spending number. But then again, you look at maybe some other areas of weakness. Brian, you and I talked, earlier today about, maybe the business spending piece, but especially that inventory piece, and, what maybe that means in terms of the economy today versus, years past.
You know, Kyle, when I was a kid, we'd build up inventory, and the way GDP is measured, it would create some pretty healthy numbers, and then we'd have too much inventory, and then we'd strip it down, and those cycles would last months, and one of the things productivity and technology has done for us is kind of shorten the gap between what people are buying and what you're building, so that these kind of feast or famine cycles have been diminished significantly, which potentially shortens or makes more shallow or takes the top off of surges and recessions and everything in between. So, the second quarter is kind of a pretty interesting argument for that very thing, where, the consumers are still spending, but inventory was reduced, and you're making kind of a nice little adjustment in terms of your expectations to slowing growth. I think the other thing you would say is, well, we kind of knew we were slowing down, right, the first quarter, and then the question is, that in and of itself isn't the worst thing in the world, but where's this thing going to end? So as long as the consumer's engaged, your point, Joel, in terms of the consumer being two-thirds of the economy, right? As long as the consumer's pretty well engaged, it's hard to see this thing, getting too ugly too fast. Then you throw in a couple other things, like next week we go back to the negotiating table with the Chinese. That's a big deal. So, as long as we're talking, there's always some possibility something good's going to happen. We got a budget deal. I don't know that I'm really excited about, but at least it keeps us from talking about it for another couple of years, right? It won't be an election issue because they've moved it past there. So you've eliminated some of the more negative things that could have caused us to think this thing was going to get ugly fast. And that in and of itself, I think, is somewhat reassuring and gives us some stability, at least in the short term.
Yeah, 121 months into this expansion, now the longest expansion on record. I think removing uncertainty right now is really key to allow markets to continue to feel good about what's going on, even if it means that things are slowing. If we can see that clearly, if we understand what the hurdles are, and if there aren't all these uncertainties that we were dealing with, are we going to go another 6 months without, without a budget negotiation getting done? Those are the kinds of things I think that really help. And then again, 121 months into now this expansion, there's some new things to think about. Joel, we're putting together an article, you and a few of the advisors here, on kind of the ways to think about not just markets, but also the economy now 121 months in. And Adam, you're quoted in that article, and I wonder if you have any thoughts kind of on where we are in this expansion, maybe what investors need to do, knowing, that maybe age isn't the only thing that matters, but certainly 121 months is a long time.
Yeah, longest economic expansion ever on record. And we still got room to run on this one. As we've discussed many times over on the podcast, expansions don't die of old age. I mean, they die of an illness. And usually it's one of two culprits. It's either, runaway inflation, or even, runaway, the cyclical sectors of the economy, the boom bust mentality. And neither one of those players are really in play at the moment. Inflation remains low. And you take a look at the cyclical sectors, residential investment, motor vehicle sales, business investment, and private inventories, three out of the four of those are either at or below their long-term average. So it's not like we're in an elevated position. So if we do get a correction, it might not be as big as people expect. It's kind of like jumping out of a first floor window. You're not jumping from an elevated position. You might not get as hurt as you might think.
All right, what kinds of things are you looking at right now?
Well, this is the best start to a year for the S&P in 20 years. I mean, that's pretty good for starters. There's an article in MarketWatch talking about, and this is kind of scary, the last time stocks did this well, Titanic was in theaters. And you know what happened to the Titanic, but I guess the movie did pretty well. it's interesting that late last year everyone was focused on trade and tweets and, you know, gee, the Fed's raised rates too much. This year it's like all's been forgotten other than occasionally there's some issues with respect to trade. So like you said, as long as there isn't anything to disturb what's going on, we can hope that stocks will continue to move higher. And as Joel pointed out in this article, or is pointing out in this article, the expansion doesn't have to just end. It could continue, and even if it does end, another expansion will start. So we're constantly helping our clients be in the game despite whatever the markets might be worried about. And it's nice to have this kind of a year following last year in which everybody was focused on the negatives. This is all positives. And when we talk about the consumer, too, the wealth effect, we haven't talked about that in a while. I mean, stocks are going up. People are going to feel good. They're going to spend more money. I think that's going to keep at least the domestic economy going for some time. So I feel pretty good about where we are.
Well, and the thing we haven't even talked about this week was, I don't know, Kyle, what, a quarter of the companies reported earnings this week?
Mm-hmm. That's
and,
right.
You know, we had pretty diminished expectations, and so you're comparing yourself against a lower bar, but nonetheless a little bit better than we thought. And so there's another thing that didn't happen is earnings didn't fall through the floor, you know. So I'd much rather have a conversation about consumer spending and earnings being halfway decent and then having a conversation about what the Fed's going to do, you know, or, you know, some of these other more political things that may not have as direct a correlation to our success going forward than actual, you know, people buying things and making things and stuff. So I thought it was a pretty good week in terms of the news cycle and in terms of what we may expect, at least in the short term.
Yeah, you know, I think the earnings piece, such a big picture, such a big piece overall of kind of what to expect for stocks. And then the other piece is interest rates. And we've got some tailwinds potentially there as well next week with what the Fed does. And so, you know, while it's maybe too early to guarantee that gets done, it's seeming pretty likely that the Fed's going to cut. And so, you know, that just further supports, I think, what's been a good year for stocks so far. And, you know, yeah, you've got these concerns overhanging about the direction of the economy, that things are slowing. Where does that end? But, you know, I think for at least a little while longer, we've got some room, Adam, I think, as you mentioned, some room to run. You know, I think the other thing that really stands out, and it's something, Brian, that you've mentioned now for the past couple of years is, you know, money isn't just chasing these publicly traded stocks. Money isn't just going into the bond markets. There's this whole other universe now of private equity where we're seeing, you know, record amounts of cash moving. I mean, a lot of that being done in place of public financing, a lot of that being done in place of, you know, putting a stock into the market and seeing what it's worth. And, you know, I think that creates a whole host of problems. I wonder what you're seeing, you know, as you kind of look at this idea of private equity and, you know, maybe what that means for investors more broadly.
Well, you know, I think sometimes, Kyle, we get so into the weeds, we need to step back and look at the big picture. And, you know, someone told me a long time ago, you know, the easiest thing to do is just to watch where the money goes, right? And the money that businesses have needed to finance growth has come from the debt markets, right? You know, so you know this. How many, what are we, half as many publicly traded stocks as there were 10 years ago? You know, well, why is that? Well, because you could borrow at 2.5% for a bajillion years and finance, you know, purchases, growth, technology, whatever it might be through the debt markets. Well, what happens when interest rates have been as low as they have for as long as they have, and at some point in time you demand to be paid more than that? You know, you're going to go back to equity financing, right? And you'll see that in the private sector first. And I mean, you know the numbers, you've seen the numbers I have, you know, technologies being financed through equity in the private sector are the record numbers the last 2 years, and those private companies will become public companies at some point in time, and maybe that's how this thing switches back into allowing not just growth through the existing equities, but a growth of equities and a growth of the number of publicly traded companies, because capital is going to go somewhere, right? And maybe that's one of the bigger paradigm shifts in terms of where we are right now.
And I think the one challenge that we see out there is that there's a limit on how many great ideas there are to invest in. And when you've got increasing dollar amounts chasing that limited number of great ideas, some of those ideas are going to be overpriced. And we've seen that with some of the stocks that have gone public in the last, you know, couple of quarters, you know, maybe maybe a little overpriced relative to long-term what they should be worth. And, you know, obviously a couple of quarters doesn't tell the full story, but I think the more you have money chasing those few great ideas in a market that's highly illiquid, that the private equity market, again, once you put that money in, it's not coming back out for a while. You know, I think it sets investors up. It sets investors who are looking at publicly traded stocks up for some expectations that maybe, you know, are a little rosier than what they should be. So something to keep an eye on if you're looking at those, you know, great ideas and stocks that maybe aren't available just yet to you publicly, but as they become available, a lot of that has been potentially overbid just based on how much money is chasing those ideas. You know, I think the other big thing that came out Thursday this week is, you know, the European Central Bank now talking about cutting rates just like the U.S., talking about increasing their bond buying program again. And I think, you know, Europe has been under kind of threat from recession basically since the Great Recession. They've never really fully recovered. And so, you know, you've got a banking crisis there that's weighed. You've got, you know, an overall demographics issue in the Eurozone, I think, that continues to weigh. And yet, you know, this idea that bond buying comes back, this idea that rates are cut, impacts the rest of the world. And certainly, you know, you look at what we've been trying to do with the strength of the dollar and potentially weakening the dollar to make it more attractive. You know, everything that happens outside the U.S. is going to impact that. And so as we look at kind of what's happening in the European Union, what's happening in the Eurozone, you know, I think that's going to be key to what we expect here in the U.S.
Yeah, Europe has been showing signs of slowing. I mean, they've been caught, I guess, you know, figuratively and literally between the crossfire of our trade war between us and China. And it's impacting their economies. They're slowing. I mean, you take a look at the export powerhouses, you know, Germany, France, Spain, you know, Japan, Canada, all of them are, you know, showing signs of slight contraction here. So I think the ECB is kind of forced with the decision, okay, well, we have to do something to increase economic momentum. And it might not just be lowering rates. Maybe it's a package of other quantitative easing measures alongside that.
And we've seen the IMF lower kind of expectations for global growth. We've seen now a couple of times because of this, you know, this ongoing trade war. And, you know, while it's largely the U.S. and China, it impacts the rest of the world. And so, you know, the Eurozone being forced to respond to that and much of the rest of the world being forced to respond to that as well.
You know, my concern is something that Bob's said a million times, but is there perhaps there's a law of diminishing returns to this stuff too, you know, and the amount of debt, you know, when does it stop actually helping, you know, when does it become kind of a short-term crutch? That's my worry, you know, and so, you know, the fact that we might be in an easing cycle again, I don't know. Again, I mean, I'd much rather talk about earnings and making stuff than what the central banks are doing. And so I think that's in the short run a little disappointing to me that we're relying once again on intervention from the central banks to make us feel better. And I don't know, in the long run, seems like a cycle that has to end at some point in time.
But it is interesting that this time around what they've done, we've talked in the past about what we call negative feedback loops versus positive feedback loops. And what they're doing, they're referring to these rate cuts. And Europe's a little more, they're reacting to something that they've got to fix. But our rate cuts over here are more like an inoculation against a potential recession. So it's not inconceivable that if we could get some resolution to the trade conflicts, or at least no more, in, you know, hiking of the hostilities, this could end well. You know, and but we have to be wary of the fact that if it, you start getting some negative information out there, the markets could go down. This has been an incredible year. And furthermore, investors are putting a lot of money, fund flows this year, into fixed income, significantly higher. As a matter of fact, we've had outflows from stock funds. So let's just enjoy the ride for now, but be cognizant of the fact this is why we keep investors well balanced, so they can make money when things go up and not lose too much money, you know, if things go the other way.
And that was a point, Art, that that you and Adam made in the article that we're working on the expansion is, you know, that balance sort of, I mean, it almost doesn't matter that we're at a record growth point in the economy, that, because you don't know when the next recession is coming. We're not seeing it anytime soon, but you never know. So, you know, you guys were pointing out that balance sort of protects you either way.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It remains the best antidote to uncertainty, and you can't predict the unpredictable, but you can sure plan for it, and that's where balance comes in.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the short term, I'm pretty encouraged by this week. You know, I think a lot of what people thought may be slower growth and recession or, you know, negative earnings, however you want to read the tea leaves or whatever. But I think in the long run, I'm still kind of cautious because I think, well, if indeed it really is about earnings and interest rates and valuations, which we've talked about forever, and I believe it is, you have interest rates that are historical lows, and that tells me there's likely one direction to go over the long run. You know, corporate earnings margins right now are the highest they've ever been. So corporate earnings as a percentage of revenues is the highest it's ever been. Well, again, common sense would dictate that sometime over the long run, there's really more likely to go one direction than the other. And those two things both don't, you know, bode well for stock prices over the long run. Now, the good news is the third one, valuations are pretty reasonable. Usually things are pretty pricey at the end of the cycle. So it isn't like you'd have to expect a correction that would take stock prices from some elevated place to correct to some normal place. We're already in a pretty normal place. So, you know, I'm optimistic about the short run, but still pretty cautious about where we're going in the long run, because there's some things that have happened in this 10-year cycle that probably need to be rectified before we have more life, I think, you know.
Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.